our diplomatic actions and using international law in a strategic way. I think that we have to recover the moral narrative of international law with a connection with Europe, with the United States, with all the progressive sectors of society everywhere. Because what is happening in Latin America is not just Latin America's problem, as what is happening in Gaza is not just the Middle Eastern problem. They are all connected, and it has to do with the United States losing hegemony internationally with the rise of China, of India, of Russia. And I think that the only way forward has to be to resist, but also to act and create resilience through a common interest that we can discover, like energy and like migration.
Senator Clara López Obregón, we have to leave it there, but we're going to do this interview in Spanish and post online at democracynow.org/ES. Yes, Colombian Senator Clara López Obregón speaking to us from Bogota. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Hugh Grant. I'll be in Santa Barbara this weekend at the International Film Festival. Hope to see people there Friday and Saturday.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Independent media is now more important than ever, and we want to know how KBOO Community Radio can best serve you. KBOO's Board of Directors invites you to a community meeting on Saturday, February 21st at 11:30 a.m. at the Clinton Street Theater and online via public video conference. This is your opportunity to share feedback, offer ideas, and help guide the station's direction. The meeting will be followed by a social hour. That's KBOO Community Radio's community meeting on Saturday, February 21st at 11:30 a.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. For more information, visit kboo.fm/community26.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a federal judge slaps a temporary restraining order on ICE in South Waterfront.
Multnomah County Homeless Services loses 25% of its budget.
In Portland's oldest music store, Music Millennium, is up for sale.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 4th, 2026. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Terrence Burns. Tear gas and pepper spray directed at peaceful protesters might be ending, at least for a little while. A temporary restraining order issued by a federal judge, Michael H. Simon, was directed at federal officers at Portland's U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement in an attempt to halt the repeated shooting and tear gassing of nonviolent protesters and journalists at the protest at the Portland ICE building. Judge Simon believes the violence by federal officers is in no way isolated. Simon said, quote, "Statements made by DHS officials and senior federal executives show that the culture of the agency and its employees is to celebrate violent responses over fair and diplomatic ones." Simon's ruling came in a case filed last year by demonstrators and freelance journalists who have accused federal officers of excessive force against peaceful protesters outside the ICE building in Portland's South Waterfront neighborhood. The property has been the focus of protests against President Donald Trump's aggressive immigration enforcement since last June. The temporary restraining order covers the area at and around the ICE building at South McAdam Avenue and Bancroft Street. The order stipulates no officer may direct or use chemical or projectile munitions, including pepper ball or paintball guns, pepper or oleoresin capsicum spray, tear gas, flash BAMF grenades, or other less than lethal weapons against a person unless that individual poses an imminent threat or physical harm to a law enforcement officer or someone else. Simon barred federal officers from firing any weapon or munition at the head, neck, or torso of anyone unless an officer is legally justified in using deadly force. Additionally, Simon says federal officers may not use chemical munitions or other projectiles against those alleged to have trespassed or refused to obey an officer's dispersal order at the ICE building. Simon set a hearing for March 2nd on the protesters' motion to turn his 14-day temporary order into a longer-lasting preliminary injunction. Judge Simon, director of the ACLU of Oregon, said, quote, "This ruling affirms that in Oregon we still love our neighbors and believe in the power of our constitutional freedoms, including the freedoms of assembly, speech, and the press, to build a better future for all of us," end quote.
Funding for Multnomah County's Homeless Services Department decreased by just over a quarter of their 2025-2026 budget. County officials say they lost roughly $87 million, putting their current budget at just $247 million. That's a decrease of 26% from the prior fiscal year. Interim Director Anna Plum told K2 Television, quote, "Our programming goes to permanent supportive housing, housing placement, and shorter-term programs. We do fund a significant number of shelters across the community for adults, families, youth, and survivors of domestic violence. We also fund employment programs and hygiene access," end quote. With the proposed cuts to the county budget, officials expect rent assistance to shrink, jobs to be cut back, and local shelters to lose funding that they depend on to provide services to already stressed county residents.
In this current short session of the Oregon Legislature, lawmakers consider the impacts of predatory lending on Oregonians. With more on that story, is Isabel Charlet.
Oregon lawmakers are considering a bill that would crack down on what proponents call predatory lending schemes that impact thousands of Oregonians each year. A new report by the Center for Responsible Lending examines lender OppFi, which charges Oregonians up to 195% interest on loans of $500 to $5,000. According to the center's Ellen Harnick, such lenders target desperate borrowers and trap them in cycles of debt, where interest paid can equal the original loan amount within a year or two.
When you have borrowers paying such extraordinary amounts of interest, then the lender doesn't need a lot of their borrowers to succeed. In fact, a lot of their borrowers can fail.
The new legislation would require all lenders operating in Oregon to comply with the state's interest rate cap of 36%, regardless of where they are based. Similar legislation was passed by the Oregon House last year, but it stalled in the Senate. Representative Nathan Sosa, one of the bill's sponsors, says online lenders exploit a federal law requiring states to honor out-of-state banks' lending terms. He explains lenders partner with Utah banks, which have no interest caps, in order to bypass Oregon's own limits.
This bill is about stating to all the lenders in our state that if you're going to do business in Oregon, you all have to comply with the laws of our state.
He adds, over the past 5 years, 22,000 of these high interest loans have been given out to Oregonians, totaling over $11 million. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
The congressional spending package that continues to fund the Department of Homeland Security included some unlikely funds for a project close to home in Oregon. The Interstate Bridge Replacement Program, meant to replace the I-5 bridge between Portland and Vancouver, won $100 million to fund the light rail part of the project. Washington Senator Patty Murray, who serves as vice chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, told OPB, quote, "Building light rail here will greatly improve connectivity between Vancouver and Portland, delivering a major win-win for Southwest Washington and Oregon," end quote. Historically, the Trump administration has been opposed to public transit. It's notable since funding for the Interstate Bridge Replacement Project was mentioned by name in the Capital Investment Grant Program, which makes reallocation of the funding more difficult in the future. Washington Representative Ed Orchid, a member of the Bi-State Legislative Committee that oversees the I-5 bridge project, said, quote, "The problem is the bridge has gotten too darned expensive. We need to start peeling some things off of this project, and light rail is the first thing that gets peeled off, not the thing that gets funded more. End quote. In 2022, the estimated price tag for the I-5 bridge replacement was between $5 to $7.5 billion. Since then, Donald Trump's tariffs, inflation, and construction delays will push the final cost up significantly. Interstate bridge replacement officials are expected to release a revised estimate next month.
Music Millennium, the Northwest's oldest and largest record store, is up for sale. Longtime owner Terry Currier said, "It's time to find a successor to keep Music Millennium going for many years to come. I've turned down every offer from developers that have called over the years wanting to buy the building," he said. "I want that building to be part of Portland's landscape forever." The store, founded in 1969, sells music in various formats and frequently hosts in-store performances and album signings. Music Millennium was the first business to print up and sell stickers saying, "Keep Portland Weird." Courier plans to be patient in finding the right owner for the building and the business. When the sale happens, he plans to take care of his wife, who has Alzheimer's, and go through his collection of over 30,000 records and CDs. "I'll downsize that to a manageable amount so I can listen for the rest of my life," he said.
A partial government shutdown is ending, but the GOP is refusing to bow to Democratic reforms for ICE. Meanwhile, Donald Trump calls for nationalizing elections, raising questions about processes central to democracy. With those stories and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I'm thrilled to sign the Consolidated Appropriations Act to immediately reopen the federal government and fund the vast majority of operations through the rest of the fiscal year.
President Donald Trump signed legislation ending the partial government shutdown. Senate Democrats blocked funds for Homeland Security due to the shootings of Renee Good and Alex Pretty in Minnesota by immigration officers. But ICE's budget was fully funded through last year's Republican megabill, which boosted it to an unprecedented $85 billion. Senate Democrats held out for ICE reforms, including independent investigations into the shootings, an end to roving patrols, a uniform code of conduct, and no more masks. DHS says agents will start using body cameras, but Republicans are pushing back on a requirement that ICE get warrants signed by a judge before going into people's homes. Speaker Mike Johnson says the current practice of getting administrative warrants issued by the department itself is better.
Imagine if we had to go through the process of getting a judicial warrant, an additional warrant, to go and apprehend people who we know are here illegally. How much time would that take? We don't have enough judges. We don't have enough time. It would take decades probably to do that.
The question is controversial. Last year, ICE agents broke down the door of a Queens, New York family home without announcing themselves, searching for someone who didn't live there. They didn't produce a warrant, but held a mother and four children at gunpoint. An investigation found administration officials told officers they could use administrative warrants to enter homes if there was a deportation order. Meanwhile, Trump is calling for elections to be taken over by the federal government rather than run by the states. The White House says the president was referring to the SAVE Act, which would implement a nationwide voter ID requirement. Trump and other national figures regularly promote conspiracy theories about non-citizen voting, but states like Utah say the SAVE Act would only complicate election administration. Nat Williams with the nonprofit Stewardship Utah says state officials have found non-citizen voting just isn't a problem.
Our lieutenant governor put out an audit of our voter rolls to check to see if there were any non-citizens on our voter rolls, and she found one non-citizen registered to vote out of 1.76 million registered voters.
This comes after Trump himself was on the phone with FBI agents during a raid on a Georgia election office central to his oft-debunked claims of winning the 2020 election. Democratic Virginia Senator Mark Warner denounced the raid and National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard's participation in it. The ranking member of Senate Intelligence says Trump and Gabbard's roles there raise numerous questions. He says systemic dismantling of election safety makes this a scary time for democracy, even in a state with a reputation for clean politics.
I have deep concerns about the fairness of our elections in 26 and 28. I have concerns about the elections in primaries in our country. I have concerns about the elections that may take place in Virginia in terms of a redistricting referendum.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth. At 6, it's PDX Progressive Talk Radio. At 7, listen in for Hard Knock Radio. Then at 8, it's Life During Wartime. Tonight's weather, expect clear skies overnight with an overnight low of 45 degrees. Tomorrow, look for afternoon sunshine with a high of 60. Today in history, lifelong civil rights activist Rosa Parks was born on this day in 1913. Parks' name will forever be synonymous with her refusal to give up her seat to a white man on a segregated bus in 1955. The quote of the day is from Rosa Parks. She said, quote, "You must never be fearful about what you are doing when it's right," end quote.
Search teams working on missing and murdered Indigenous people cases must prepare themselves for the likelihood they will come across a body. One group based in Portland, Oregon, is proactively preparing volunteers for that potential encounter. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Search teams working on missing and murdered Indigenous people cases must prepare themselves for the likelihood they'll come across a body. One group based in Portland is proactively preparing volunteers for that encounter. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports.
Inside an anatomy lab, William Borman, professor of basic sciences for the University of Western States, carefully turns a cadaver over on a metal table. A tinge of formaldehyde fills the air. Seven volunteers with the group MMIW Search and Hope Alliance examine its tendons, nerves, and organs.
This is a
murder
right here.
Kimberly Lenning is the group's founder. She says she's seen death up close many times.
And I think through my years of traumatic experiences with violent death, I've seen a lot. It's prepared me, I think, just through the fire, like steel is forged through fire.
But for most people, exposure to death and corpses isn't a recurring thing. So Lenning reached out to Borman to arrange a visit. Not only does it gird people for when they find a body, but it helps them discern between human and animal remains. Two volunteers, Sabrina Griffith and Isabella Regalado, said they would recommend this experience.
The veins, the actual ligaments, the muscles, it was quite surprising to see it and feel it in real life. I've only touched bones and stuff like that, so it's very interesting to actually feel the inner part of our body.
It's actually been better than anticipated. I thought it would be a little bit more gruesome, but everyone has been very professional and understanding and doing their best to educate everyone else.
Lenning and Borman remind people that viewing cadavers isn't the same as coming across a corpse, whether that's in the wilderness or city. Such bodies aren't preserved, and beyond what the cause of death inflicted, would be subject to the elements and scavengers.
If it's in the wilderness, in the forest, bears, cougars, wolves, they're going to tear at stuff and leave the bones. So definitely pieces more than together.
Near the end of the visit, Borman sprayed a blue hydrating liquid to keep the cadavers from drying out and developing mold. He said everyone in Lenning's group was respectful and asked great questions.
I'm pleased that we were able to make this happen. If she were interested in doing it again, I'd be open to doing it again.
Lenning and her volunteers gave small gifts of gratitude to Borman and thanked him for his time. MMIW Search and Hope Alliance is preparing for two search efforts in the next few weeks. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull in Portland, Oregon.
An Irish language activist has won a landmark decision in Northern Ireland following her arrest during a protest. Show McPullen has more.
74-year-old grandmother Moira Vicinalli attended a peaceful protest in support of the Palestinian people last August in Belfast. She was among those arrested under the UK's controversial terrorism laws because of her T-shirt. During the arrest, English-speaking police officers were unable to understand her as she gave them her address because she spoke in her indigenous language of Irish. The police ombudsman ruled last week that the arresting officer should have taken reasonable steps to arrange a translation service and that Vicinalli experienced, quote, oppressive behavior. The police watchdog also issued a policy recommendation for future engagements with Irish language speakers. Vicinale's lawyer says this decision, quote, puts a marker down for how the police service must respect the Irish language moving forward. For National Native News, I'm Sean McPollin in Ireland.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A federal judge has blocked the Trump administration's attempt to end temporary protective status for Haitians, bringing relief to families. But advocates warn the uncertainty is far from over. Farah Siddiqui reports on how the news impacted the Haitian community in Springfield, Ohio.
A federal judge has blocked the Trump administration's attempt to end temporary protected status for Haitians, a decision that immediately affects hundreds of thousands of people nationwide. In Springfield, Ohio, home to a large Haitian community, local leaders say the ruling brought relief, even as uncertainty remains. The decision came after weeks of anxiety in Springfield, where faith leaders and community groups had been preparing for the possibility of mass deportations. Carl Ruby, senior pastor of Central Christian Church, says he learned of the ruling while driving.
I pulled off the road and wept. It was such a huge relief. And then I started calling Haitian members of my congregation and letting them know, and many of them wept. There's no way to comprehend the sense of relief that decision brought.
The ruling keeps TPS in place for Haitians who have lived and worked legally in the U.S. for years, many of whom came after the 2010 earthquake and later political violence. The decision is expected to be appealed. Immigration advocates say the ruling offers breathing room, but not stability. Lynn Tremonte is executive director of the Ohio Immigration Alliance. She says families have been living in limbo while waiting on court decisions.
You've got thousands of people around the country who are living their life based on a court decision. They can't make plans. They don't know where they'll be next year. They don't know what schools to enroll their kids in.
Tremonte says Congress still has the power to create a permanent path forward, while Ruby and other Springfield leaders say the ruling shows how deeply immigration decisions ripple through local communities. For now, Haitian families in Ohio can stay, but advocates say the fight over TPS is far from over. For Ohio News Connection, I'm Farah Siddiqui.
A new set of concerns are being raised about the Trump administration's aggressive immigration enforcement and its impacts on health care. People who study health policy say there's legitimate worry that sensitive information could be shared, even in situations when the courts say it shouldn't happen. Mike Moen has more.
Health policy researchers are monitoring potential movement on the sharing of sensitive information with federal immigration authorities. The crisis in Minnesota is reviving talks about the impacts on public health programs and people with legal status. Minnesota and nearly 20 other states last year filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services after it entered a Medicaid data-sharing agreement with ICE. A judge eventually allowed some of this activity with strict limitations. Leo Cuellu with Georgetown University's Center for Children and Families reiterates that undocumented immigrants aren't eligible for full Medicaid coverage, but providers are reimbursed for emergency care. And he says such care extends to other populations.
It's a whole group of lawfully present people, including people on student visas, legal permanent residents who are in a waiting period, exchange visitors, tourist visas, temporary protected status. So there are many, many people who are in the swirl of this.
He says the court order blocks info sharing concerning lawfully present people, while warning the mere thought can deter someone from seeking help. Cuellu says the same goes for immigrants who are U.S. citizens planning to enroll in Medicaid. The center says there isn't a full read yet on what's been shared, but it believes federal officials are taking steps. In setting rules, the courts did say the Department of Homeland Security has broad authority to obtain data from other agencies for legitimate immigration enforcement. The Trump administration has made separate demands in Minnesota, pressuring state officials to turn over welfare and voter information. That has prompted questions about federal overreach. As for the Medicaid sharing, Cuellu says a pressing concern is the birth of U.S. citizen babies.
Half of the emergency Medicaid money goes to labor and delivery. And so if you have an immigrant who is here lawfully or undocumented, who is afraid to go to the emergency room because their data is going to be shared when they are pregnant, that means the birth of a U.S. citizen might not happen in the safest way possible.
Prior to recent events, a late fall survey from KFF and the New York Times found that 51% of immigrant adults were worried about information sharing within the healthcare arena. Last month, Minnesota providers held a news conference where they detailed situations of vulnerable families avoiding important care. This is Mike Mullen for Minnesota News Connection.
Federal officials are sending unclear messages about how soon they might reduce the presence of armed federal immigration agents in Minnesota. Opposition is still playing out in neighborhoods as residents observe and document civil rights violations. Large-scale protests are happening from time to time, too, and a new survey provides insight on Minnesotans standing in solidarity with their neighbors. Mike Mullen has more.
As Congress debates the tactics of immigration and customs enforcement, data is emerging on how Minnesotans are expressing their frustrations, including a recent day of action that garnered national attention. A new poll from May Day Strong, a coalition of labor unions, reveals that nearly a quarter of those surveyed said they or a loved one took part in a statewide strike on January 23rd. On that day, residents were urged to refrain from work, school, and shopping. An estimated 50,000 people also marched through downtown Minneapolis in sub-zero temperatures. There have also been tributes to Renee Good and Alex Preddy after they were fatally shot by federal agents. Bruce Blaze of Blaine took part in a bike ride for Preddy, and he noticed a lot of people cheering from the sidelines.
And along the route, there was lots of residents along the route that were urging us on. They were behind our movement.
Participants say the demonstrations in Minnesota and around the country illustrate that many Americans feel the Trump administration is going too far with its deportation strategy. After voting to end a partial government shutdown, Congress faces a short negotiating window to secure reforms to the Department of Homeland Security. A stopgap measure extends funding for DHS until February 13th. Democrats want to end practices like roving patrols, while Republicans renew calls to target sanctuary cities. Local residents speaking up about ICE's presence in Minnesota have consistently noted that people documenting arrests are not violent protesters, but instead neighbors caring for neighbors. They say the marches and rallies are an extension of the resistance. Blaze walks around in a safety vest with the words "Peaceful Observer" stretched across the back. He feels that ancestors who served in the military and defended the U.S. and its allies would have done the same.
My dad and all of his fellow combat veterans of World War II are spinning in their graves right now, knowing if they knew what was going on in this nation.
The May Day Strong survey was conducted over a three-day period immediately after the January 23rd day of action, with responses from nearly 2,000 likely voters in Minnesota. Nearly half of respondents felt the event was an effective way for people to exercise their rights and show opposition. This is Mike Mullen for Minnesota News Connection.
The state of Utah's sensitive materials law views high school students and kindergartners through the same lens. Bill Newman has more on the story.
Ready to hear the titles of books recently censored, banned, removed from school libraries in Utah? I'm Bill Newman for the Civil Liberties Minute. Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, Khalid Hosseini's The Kite Runner, Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, all pulled off the shelves to comply with the state's overbroad sensitive materials law. A law that requires Utah school libraries to toss out every book that contains even a single fleeting description of sex, no matter its content, no matter how age-appropriate, no matter how acclaimed, valuable, and important the book is. Hundreds of books have been removed. Books by Nobel Prize winners, National Book Award finalists, and Presidential Medal of Freedom recipients. An unsurprising result, perhaps, given that the law treats a 17-year-old preparing for college the same as a kindergartner learning to sound out words. We're not making this up. In January, the ACLU of Utah sued in federal court, seeking an order that the law be declared unconstitutional and the books returned to the shelves. Sadly, Utah is part of a nationwide trend of states enacting such censorship laws, so what happens there may well matter everywhere. As ACLU of Utah attorney Tom Ford summarized, this law silences authors, denies students access to ideas, violates the First Amendment, and must be struck down. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU.
KBOO news poet Dan Raphael is thinking that politically, 2026 will be, well, a wild ride.
Trump's talking about federalizing the elections, maybe call an insurrection. His poll numbers are down. Melania has a movie and he doesn't. Why can't his minions stop people from rising up? Several thousand here on Saturday with strong words after from Mayor Wilson and Governor Kotek. Minnesota showing widespread resistance with other protests and campaigns all over the country. Let's make America a democracy again. A first step is to make the Democratic Party democratic again. We kind of stuck for the moment with a two-party system. Let's see what the Dems in D.C. get out of the current budget impasse. When the biggest threat to Homeland Security is Homeland Security. When the head of the War Department is aching to live up to that name. The Attorney General is the Attack Dog General. Department of Injustice. Department of Draining the Treasury. The federal government is too far gone at the moment. Many more of the states need to speak up for their people and the country as a whole. States got the power. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 4th, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Dave Johnson, Anna Francis, and Rain Crow. The producer is Dave Johnson, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Edward J. Vieira, Isabel Charlet, Antonia Gonzalez, Bill Newman, Mike Moen, and Farah Siddiqui. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO's News in Depth.